Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, a Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. On April 18th and 19th, Fidelity Investments Canada hosted Focus 2024, a two-day event for advisors featuring insights from Fidelity's portfolio managers and subject matter experts. Today's podcast is our Global Asset Allocation Team session from the event, with host Pat Balland sitting down with portfolio managers David Wolf, David Tulk, and institutional portfolio manager Alain Colette. The team currently manages over $84 billion on behalf of Canadian investors, and today they'll share more about their process, how they are currently positioned, including overweights and underweights, where they are adding value, and more. Today's podcast was recorded on April 19th, 2024.
Actually, David was a little bit remiss. It is your 10-year anniversary of the managed portfolios. Autumn last year, I think it was. And David Wolf, I'll get to you in a second. David Tulk, why do you think these things have been so successful, you know, the amount of money that's come into them?
Yeah, that's a great way to start the conversation. First, I should certainly extend my welcome to everybody. What makes, I think, our managed portfolios successful is really the fact that they're built to leverage the best of Fidelity. So that comes in terms of how we construct them. So we're the asset allocators. So we're taking the best Fidelity managers across asset classes, across geographies, across different styles, across different factors, and bringing them together into a balanced, diversified solution. So that's really the first step, is building the team of really strong security selectors and allowing them to really do what they do best, leveraging their research. And then on top of that, we take an active allocation approach. So that really comes in two forms. The first is to take overweights and underweights to different asset classes, different geographies, that's informed by our four-step process. So thinking about the macro, using bottom-up observations, thinking about valuation and sentiment, and that informs how we want to position broad asset classes relative to the benchmark. But what we also do is take out-of-benchmark allocations. And the motivation for this is really to find themes or ideas that we think exist outside of the benchmark that we want to bring into the fund. And we can use specialized Fidelity managers, we can use ETFs, we can use futures capabilities, so a wide range of tools to add additional sources of return to the funds. And another motivation to use out-of-benchmark allocations is if there's a risk out there in the market or in the economy that we've identified and we want to protect the portfolio from. So again, an example of inflation, we can use inflation-protected government debt, we can use commodities as different asset classes to bring in to really, at the end of the day, add value consistently through the cycle. That's certainly an important starting point for us. But where we really want to provide value, and recognizing that these are core solutions for investors, is to provide protection and risk management. So when the market is uncertain, when the market's under pressure, that's really where we want to shine as asset allocators.
Okay. Now, David Wolf, you were there basically 10 years ago. I wonder, and they're all balanced portfolios that you're working with, is the 60-40 kind of back, do you think, is it popular again, an easy solution?
So, I mean, I appreciate the question because it kind of gets to the heart of what we do as multi-asset portfolio managers. Because there have been a question, particularly if you go back to 2022. So 2022, as unfortunately everybody will remember, was a pretty awful year for everything, including for 60-40 or the kind of balanced portfolios that we run. Stocks were down double digits, bonds were down double digits, and the kicker was they were down at the same time. And that was frankly not supposed to happen, right? So the way that 60-40 has worked its magic over the past 30 years has been the bonds hedge the stocks. So if you get an equity drawdown, bonds do better, so they both contribute over time, but they also offset one another to mitigate the volatility. That didn't happen in 2022. The strategies have come roaring back. 60-40 is back to some degree. Having said that, the correlation problem still exists in the following sense. So as I mentioned, 2022 is bad because everything went down together. The last 16 months or so, generally speaking, everything has gone up together, which is great, and nobody complains about that nearly as much, but it's still everything moving together is disturbing, because when you get this positive correlation between stocks and bonds, bonds simply aren't as good a hedge for your overall portfolio has been the case previously. So, and we can unpack later in the session if folks would like, in terms of why that correlation is flipped and what we think is going to happen going forward. But the summary that I would give is bonds, we think, are just not going to be as reliable a diversifier in multi-asset funds as they have been historically. They still have a place, but they're not as reliable. So what are we doing in that context? So the first thing we're doing is we're making good use of, as DT talked about, the breadth of capabilities that we have. So we have a lot of tools, a lot of smaller asset classes that give diversified return streams. So emerging market local currency debt, floating rate notes, convertibles, a lot of asset classes that are hard for individual investors to access but can give us some diversification that ordinary treasuries, investment grade bonds are not being able to do any longer. We have active allocation tools, so one we've been using a lot is currency. So even as bonds have become less of a hedge to stocks, the US dollar has remained very highly negatively correlated to equities. So even if you have no view on the Canadian dollar versus the US dollar, it helps to have those dollars in the portfolio because the dollar is going to tend to go up when equities go down. And then the final thing that we're doing is we're always looking to sort of push the envelope in terms of what we include in these funds to fulfill our goal of maximizing risk-adjusted returns. And alternatives are a very rich vein for us. And we've been talking about that much of yesterday with Dave and with Dan DuPont. And I know Andrew and Ritu are going to come up and talk about their liquid alternatives. So we're doing two things. First, as was announced nearly a year ago, I think it is, we've entered into a partnership with Brookfield to establish a new capability that we're going to introduce in our private investment pools to invest in private real estate directly. We haven't funded that yet, and we're not going to do so until the commercial real estate environment is sufficiently cleared and sufficiently supportive. And we think it's actually a real advantage of having a new capability because everybody knows, you know, office in particular, commercial real estate generally, you know, is under pressure from higher interest rates, changes in working arrangements. So having a brand new capability unencumbered by legacy assets gives us the opportunity to get in where we think the price is right, where we get the right assets. So that's going to be something that we think is going to be helpful to those funds. And then finally, the liquid alternatives that we've been talking about. And there's a wide variety of these strategies. They're all good, but we need to be very deliberate, as we always are with the multi-asset funds, about introducing not only new managers, but particularly new asset classes. Because what matters to us is not so much what a capability does, but how it fits with everything else that we have in the portfolio. So we need to observe it. We need to understand the behavior. We need to analyze it and size and shape where we think it will fit in. So that's still an ongoing process, but we like what we've seen. And so, you know, we're certainly looking at being able to push the envelope and including more of those alternatives in the multi-asset class fund.
I may come back and unpack that, the new normal as you're describing it, but you know, people want to hear about your outlooks overall. So Ilan, how are you?
Good. Great.
To see you. Way down at the other end of the stage, man. Good to see you this morning, nicely dressed up. You've got the formal attire on.
I thought we're in the right city for that. I mean, you know. Yeah.
You have been talking as a group, we've been talking for years, you've been addressing one big issue that's now in the press, so I think it's timely, productivity. What are your thoughts right now on productivity?
Sure, yeah. I mean, productivity is an interesting one, right? This is something that, you know, as economists, as nerds, we've been thinking about for years, but, you know, it's like 10 years ago, not a lot of people were talking about this, like, you know, sort of like oat milk. I mean, and now everyone's talking about it. And so I think really the question that we need to unpack here is, what is productivity? What are the ingredients and why does it matter, right? Those are the questions. So productivity is normally measured by things like output per hour or output per worker, right? That's a very easy concept to measure when you're making machines on a production line, right? It's very easy to measure in the goods sector. It's more difficult to measure in the services sector. The ingredients for productivity or productivity growth are capital, labor, and how you use the two together, right? So for capital or capital deepening, that's things like, giving someone, for example, who tilled the field with a cow, a better implement. That's probably the least relatable anecdote, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't think there's many farmers
right,
in the
okay,
room.
Yeah,
but...
so, yeah, I mean, another way to do that, for example, is give people the right tools, right? So give people the right software and computers, et cetera, to be more productive at their job, right? So that's the capital part. Second part is the labor, right? And this is training, this is capital deepening, this is moving up the education spectrum, right? This is, that's really deepening that quality of the labor. And then the third ingredient for productivity is how you use the two together, which is normally kind of a function of management. It's, and again, very, very hard to measure. Those are the three ingredients for productivity. You know, investing in any or all of those will boost productivity. And the reason productivity is so important is because productivity is part of the equation for the potential growth rate of a of an economy. So I know this is the first session, and I know we're getting pretty nerdy here, but just stick with me for a few more seconds. So the potential growth rate of an economy, right, is the economy is the rate of growth that an economy can grow at without igniting inflation, right? In short, the way to boost potential growth is either with stronger productivity, right, capital deepening, labor, or multi-factor, or two, add more people, right? And so when you boost potential growth, the amazing thing with that, which normally comes from that productivity angle, is you get higher rates of growth, you get more growth, more jobs, more, you know, higher wages, and most importantly, I think right now, is you inoculate, I should use a different word, insulate an economy against elevated rates of inflation or more volatile inflation, right? So productivity is critically important. It's something we should all be interested in. It is the magic ingredient for long-term sustainable growth and raising standards of living. And when it lags, it's detrimental, right? So it's critical and yeah.
What's the status of it right now, for instance, in the United States, and especially compare it around the world?
Yeah, so I mean, another way of putting what Alon was saying is productivity is critical to the current debate on a soft landing
yeah.
in the US in particular, but also in the rest of the world. I mean, one way to put it is if you have strong productivity growth, that's how you get a soft landing, because you can extend the economic growth while still getting down inflation because the economy's capacity is going up, supply is going up, so demand is not putting as much pressure on supply, so you don't get the price increases. If you don't have productivity gains, then you're stuck. You have to make a really lousy trade-off. Either if you allow growth to continue because capacity isn't going up, you're keeping on putting pressure on supply and putting pressure on prices. Or if you want to get inflation down, you need a recession to get rid of that demand because supply isn't growing. So productivity, in our view, is the key to can we execute and sustain the soft landing that seems to be underway in the United States. My answer to that is I think we can. I think there is something very positive going on with respect to productivity growth in the US. That comes from a couple of places. So one, technology, particularly AI. I think we're at the early stages of adoption in terms of the impact of AI on the economy, on businesses. I thought Salim's comments yesterday in introducing global microcap and how we were able to do that was a great example of that way. I mean, you know, Fidelity and all of our analysts already create all of this information, all of these hundreds of thousands of research reports, but until the chat GPTs of the world, we didn't have a good way of integrating and summarizing all of that, because no matter, you know, even if you're Joel, you can't read that many research reports, but the computer can. And so that's a way that technology has allowed a company like ours to create new products and to innovate in a way that ultimately feeds economic productivity for us and for other firms that are able to do the same thing. So there's something very positive going on that way. Second thing on productivity is what's happening with infrastructure investment. And that's clean energy, but not only clean energy. The degree of capital spending on public, you know, on grid, on factories, on bridges, et cetera, has really shot up in the United States. That's the kind of thing that helps productivity over time. It gives you more infrastructure. to work with. And then the third that has been, I think, more important than recognized, but is really hard to pin down, particularly in real time, is what I've called changes in working arrangements. So basically what the pandemic did is it blew up a 100-year-old paradigm of you go into the office, you sit there from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, mm-hmm. and that's your work week. That made a ton of sense if you are a factory worker 100 years ago. It still makes sense in a lot of jobs, but for those of us in this room, it doesn't make a lot of sense if you're a knowledge worker. And so the pandemic leading us to a more flexible set of working arrangements is more efficient. It allows us to manage our lives better. And it's not true that for every job that will improve productivity. When I say, yeah, this is great for productivity, my former public sector colleagues are like, are you kidding? You know, it was hard enough to get people to do stuff when they were in the office, and now there's no chance. But for the economy as a whole, greater efficiency, better ways of managing our lives should lead to higher output per hour and an expansion of productivity. So I think all of these things are happening in the US. The data are reflecting this to some degree. The jury is still out, and Andrew spoke yesterday morning about, you know, the assumption that productivity is growing and maybe questioning that with some of the recent inflation prints. Absolutely valid and something that we need to keep an eye on. But, you know, I think that there's certainly grounds for optimism that the degree to which productivity growth has risen, allowing the economy to keep growing, inflation to come down, and ultimately the soft landing that markets want and need, I think we can still be pretty optimistic about that.
Okay, so optimistic soft landing. You're certainly within the context of the United States. David Tog, bring that to Canada for us, if you could.
So this will be a nomination for the shortest answer that we've ever given on stage, and the answer is no. I'll unpack that a little bit,
yes, I think, please,
for everyone's benefit. So no, the productivity story that underpins the optimism we have around the US and the soft landing simply does not translate to Canada. And there's a long-standing challenge that Canada has faced on the productivity front. I like to joke that we've spent more money and time studying productivity than actually investing in productivity. I'd reference a recent speech by the Senior Deputy Governor of the Bank of Canada, who quite plainly described this as a Canadian emergency, where it's a break the glass type of moment, that the lack of productivity for any number of different reasons in Canada is a significant challenge to the economy. So to think a bit about that, I'll paraphrase what Alon mentioned in terms of how you grow an economy. You can use productivity or you can use people. And in Canada, we've generally used people in the recent cycle. We've seen a huge increase in immigration, and that has also corresponded to a fairly large increase in residential investment, which compared to other kinds of investment isn't nearly as productive as deepening your capital and investing on the business side of the economy. So all of that has left Canada in a pretty significant challenge, at least from the productivity story. So if you are looking for productivity globally, or most notably in the US, to engineer the soft landing, you really cannot carry that optimism into the Canadian economy. And that comes back to the highest core conviction view we have as a team, is to remain underweight Canadian assets. Because if you look beyond that productivity story and just identify other parts of Canada, you know, Canada's in a really difficult position for many of the reasons we've talked about at great length on this stage and others, that we face a significant challenge when it comes to household leverage. We have a clear catalyst, and it's a slow burn catalyst in terms of higher interest rates that will continue to impact the economy over the next couple of years. And without any other sort of source of optimism at this stage to drive economic growth, it does put Canada in a pretty difficult position. And that's a theme that we certainly want to invest around.
Okay, so then we got a question from the app. Do you have an opinion on how the proposed federal Canadian budget will impact productivity?
That's a touchy topic, certainly, when you think of the spending priorities. I think, you know, certainly putting money into the economy to address housing is certainly valuable, but that has to also be taken in the context of when you've really relied on population growth, and now that door has closed to a pretty significant degree as well, and we might see additional headwinds with a change in government after the next election. We'll definitely not try to speculate too much on that front. But, you know, if you had been driving your economy on population growth and that narrative changes, then again, you're even more in a deeper hole of trouble. So to me, there wasn't anything dramatic in the budget that can provide solutions to this issue. And that goes to the underscoring of productivity, that the roots of Canada's productivity challenges are really deeper than any one federal budget. It's really fundamentally due to a lack of productivity in key sectors like banking and telecom, lack of competition, again, a focus on a lot of residential investment at the expense of other kinds of investment. Those are factors that I think any policymaker today will really struggle to challenge, to fix in a short period of time. It's a deeper national reckoning that will need to take place, and that ultimately will take quite some time, if ever, to actually resolve itself.
Thanks very much for the question. It's a nice one to have. Productivity was a big one you discussed in the past. Inflation is another big one that you've discussed in the past. Ilan, you're the go-to person on inflation. Where do we stand right now?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I look forward again to a time when we don't care about inflation like we did, you know, 10 years ago. So we all know what happened with inflation, right? Inflation pushed much higher. We got higher rates of inflation in Canada and the US than in Mexico and India, right? We never thought we would observe this type of inflationary shock. Where we are now is there's been a meaningful progress on the rate of inflation, right? So inflation has gone, let's say underlying core measures of inflation have gone from around 6 to around 3-ish, right? And I'm talking about Canada and the US. And that's a significant amount of progress, but that progress has really slowed pretty measurably in the last couple of months. Both definitely in the US and to a certain extent in Canada as well. Now, to be very, very clear, and I know perhaps all of us in this room understand this, nothing is going for sale, right? So a slowing rate of inflation doesn't mean anything is becoming cheaper. It means that things are getting more expensive slower. I know that's a terrible thing to tell people, but I mean, that's the reality of it. But again, the slowing rate of inflation has meaningful implications for rates and central banks, and there has been a significant improvement. But again, as Andrew mentioned yesterday when we opened, you know, the U.S. is sitting at a core inflation rate, so that's less food and energy. That's the underlying core calculation. That's in the mid-threes, right? And so we had a tremendous improvement, and now we're moving sideways. This has been our thesis for a long time, that move from, I don't know, call it 8 to 4 or 6 to 3, would be fairly easy and mechanical, and that last mile would take a little bit longer, right? And would be a sort of a stubbornly sticky road back to targets. I do think we will get there, right? It's essential for central bank credibility. But right now, an extremely tight labor market is pushing wages higher. Wages are pushing service prices higher. Services are 3/4 of the underlying pie, right? So again, some of you will have heard this, but my father-in-law is 81. He goes to Costco. Whenever he comes back from Costco, he tells me the prices of things that have gone up and down at Costco. I mean, that's kind of interesting. I mean, no, it's not. But I mean, so, you know.
It's interesting he does his own shopping at 81.
Anyway, so, you know, you got to listen. So the prices of things go up and down. That might be interesting, but that's only 25% of that pie. What matters much more are the price of people, right? And because of a tight labor market, wages are running at a rate that is higher than we've seen pre-pandemic for 20 years, and that's pushing services higher. It's as mechanical as that, right?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because you're breaking it down into two parts, wage inflation and food inflation. Media picks up on the food inflation side of things while creeping up is wage inflation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so again, I don't want to be dismissive of food inflation, right? The food inflation that we've observed both in Canada and the US is staggering, right? And again, food inflation, the reason central banks remove it from their thinking of underlying inflation is because it's volatile, right? And not because we don't consume it, but they generally remove the volatile items like food and energy because what they're trying to get at is what is the underlying trend of inflation, because that's a good predictor of where inflation might be 12 or 24 months from now. Again, the relative change, the change in the level of prices that we've observed in the last 2 or 3 years is unbelievable, right? So groceries are up 20%, eating out is up 20%. I mean, I didn't get a 20% raise, but you know, so we're all worse off. And it's detrimental, right? It's significant.
Yeah. And it's important, as you pointed out, to interest rates and the bond market. So David Talk, I want you to take that over if you could.
Yeah, no, it's clearly something that's very topical right now, and especially as you contemplate the soft landing narrative and Canada's challenge as well. So a little bit of the story on inflation being more persistent has really made us as a team hesitant to add a lot of duration into the portfolios. So our view that inflation would be stickier than the market, and our view that central banks would not be as quick to cut interest rates as the bond market had believed last year, prompted us to remain underweight duration. And as UW mentioned in one of his answers, to provide defense into our balanced funds, we weren't relying on bonds to provide that, we were relying on currency. So it allowed us to be a little bit more circumspect in terms of how we were thinking about duration. And as time has rolled on and as US yields hits our local peak late last year, we took that opportunity to say, you know what, this theme of being underweight duration has probably run its course. We want to now maybe take a much more neutral position on duration. Bond market pricing for central banks was arguably closer to being fairly priced and looking at maybe two or three rate cuts as opposed to the six previously. All-in yield was a little bit more compelling as well. So we neutralized our duration position. But it's important to note as well is that we haven't really, again, embraced a large overweight to duration at this stage, because there still is, in our view, some persistence to inflation. The market's reassessing the narrative on how much central banks are likely to cut interest rates. And that, again, forces us to be a little bit more cautious. And because we have the currency to provide defense, that's a much easier and more compelling option. So being neutral on overall duration is an important part of our positioning when it comes to fixed income. But at the same time, we're using an underweight to investment grade to fund overweights into credit. So we still think that credit and plus sectors have a compelling role to play in our portfolio. We talk to the managers frequently. We have a lot of confidence in their ability to bring security selection into the portfolio. A lot of these lower grade credit companies have used the low interest rate environment to term out their debt. So arguably, they're a little bit less rate sensitive than they would have been in prior cycles. And that has given us confidence to maintain those plus sector allocations on the bond side of the portfolio.
So that David Wolf was talking about squeezing or getting more yields. That's where you're squeezing extra yield out, is on the credit side?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, no questions on inflation, so let's move on. Everybody down here, I saw it in the paper just the other day, presidential election, and they talk about how the market's gonna be great forever, at least until November. So I'd love you guys to weigh in on that. I don't know which one, who wants to start with this? David Wolf.
Yeah, I'll start. I mean, so there's a pretty regular presidential cycle as it relates to markets, as you were alluding to. So what tends to happen is equity markets actually do relatively well into an election, a presidential election in that fourth year of the cycle. That tends to be particularly true when you have a down year in the midterm elections, as we did in 2022. I know Urian has some stuff on this. He's going to be speaking later, so he'll do a much better job of talking about that cycle than I can. But it kind of makes sense that would generally be the dynamic, because you think about what's happening in the last year of a presidential cycle, usually. Everybody wants to get reelected, right? Yeah. President wants to get reelected, Congress wants to get reelected, and what do? You stimulate, you give people money, you build stuff, et cetera. So you get fiscal stimulus that juices the economy, tends to make the economy better, tends to make the stock market better going into an election. This phenomenon is not exclusive to the United States. I think there's good reason to believe that this cycle isn't gonna work quite that way. And the biggest reason is we've already seen the big fiscal stimulus, and Andrew talked about that yesterday. Others have talked about it. The likelihood that you're gonna get marginal additional fiscal stimulus over the next several months in the US looks like it's pretty close to zero, right? And that has to do with the fact you already have a big deficit. With this president and this Congress, the chances that you get a big set of tax cuts and get anything material done for the economy looks pretty small, right? Mm. So if you don't get that marginal fiscal impetus, the reason why you get that presidential cycle rally into the election probably isn't there. Now, that's not to say that it can't happen, and we're mindful of these patterns in history and the data, but we don't want to rely on that history repeating itself in terms of the risk stance that we're taking in the funds. Mm.
You look like you wanted to say something. Go ahead, David.
I think it's also, I mean, there's a natural tendency of the market to just focus on the election day and not spend as much time thinking about what comes next. And that's an important part of the story for us, because if you look at, I mean, we haven't really seen candidate platforms yet, but at least if you follow the Twitter feeds, you get a sense of what people are thinking. And there is certainly a risk post-election that you could see more fiscal stimulus. So you might not see anything between now and the election date, but the environment following the election could potentially see a great deal of stimulus. And that stimulus certainly is entirely politically driven. It's not at all economically driven, because if you, again, reflect on the state of the U.S. economy, arguably it doesn't need additional stimulus at this stage of the game. So if you wanted to just go back to that notion on duration and on how you want to position around a bond portfolio and thinking about central banks maybe not cutting as much as the market thinks, conceivably, if you get a ton of fiscal stimulus post-election over the next couple of years, that, again, that argues that central banks would probably not feel the need to cut interest rates and instead let the fiscal side do additional stimulus. If anything, that's a risk that central banks may not cut at all or by as much as what the market's predicted. So that's just something to reorient people to think just beyond simply the election date and wonder what's going to happen between now and then, but take that holistic view through a longer period of time.
Ilan?
Yeah, just to add something, I mean, to be quite frank, it's not our edge, right? So our edge is not, I think this person's going to win and this investable asset class is going to do this. That's not our edge. Our edge, and this has shown up in the results, is assembling a fantastic team and then using the four-pillar research process to lean in or out of asset classes, right, for medium to long-term investors. I mean, we certainly think about it as DW and DT just discussed, but that's not our edge.
Good point. Your edge is positioning. So let's talk about positioning, because it was touched on by David. David Wolf, where are we as far as positioning for Canadian investors?
Yeah, so we've alluded to a number of the more significant positions that we have on, but maybe let me summarize with a tactical point and then a more structural point. So the tactical point is we are underweight Canadian assets. We have been for some time, we remain so. DT talked a fair bit about the productivity challenges, the high leverage and higher interest rate challenges that are facing the domestic economy. So we want to be underweight Canadian assets, but we don't want to be underweight all Canadian assets. Not only are there always good companies domestically, but there is also something, as Hugo was talking about extensively yesterday, going on in the commodity sector. So, you know, not for nothing, for example, you know, gold has been shooting up, oil has been shooting up. The Fidelity Inflation Focus Fund, which we launched 3 years ago, is a package of inflation-related assets whose largest component is materials and energy stocks, has been going to the upside. And so that bears on inflation, but it also bears on the fact that if this is, as Hugo said, the beginning of a hard asset cycle, that's going to be good for Canada. And we're mindful of that, and we don't want to lean against that. So the way we've structured the portfolio, we're underweight, shall we say, the domestic-facing side mm-hmm. of the Canadian market. That's banks, that's consumer companies, et cetera. We're significantly underweight the Canadian dollar. And that has to do with the fact that the bank is, at least in our opinion, going to be much more motivated to cut interest rates over the next 12 to 18 months than the Fed is going to be able to be, and we can unpack that a little bit later if you'd like to. But we don't want to be underweight the commodity sectors. So we've leaned into those sectors within Canada, and we have on the other side significant holdings in gold, in global energy and material stocks. So we want to make sure that if our thesis is right on Canada with respect to the domestic economy, we're benefiting from that. But if the other side, the commodity side of the economy, is doing better, that we have enough leverage to that within the funds that we're going to perform well too.
Okay, except I'm in the, and you mentioned oil, I'm kind of in the petrocurrency camp. I got to admit, oil drives what's happening in the Canadian dollar. You're underweight in the Canadian dollar, and yet oil prices are improving very much. I think, David, you and I talked about this in the past, haven't we? What are your thoughts on oil prices as it relates to the Canadian dollar?
Yeah, certainly. So the currency, the Canadian dollar, it has at various points in its history been a petrocurrency, but it's important to realize there's a whole host of factors that can drive the performance of the Canadian dollar. So one of the exercises that we pay a great deal of attention to is looking at those rolling correlations with a wide swath of asset classes. So the correlation with oil prices, as we've seen recently and has extended actually back quite some time, has really broken down. So instead, what we've noticed that's replaced that correlation is risk sentiment more generally. So you can use a US equity market index as a proxy for that. So that tighter correlation, again, underscores the notion that you can use the Canadian dollar as a way to protect the portfolio against volatility by being underweight a cyclical currency like the Canadian dollar with a preference for being overweight to the US. So that correlation, again, is something that we've paid a lot of attention to. It's even more dominant than relative interest rate spreads and some of the other more classic drivers of a currency pair. So that sense of being aware of risk sentiment and how the market is performing is really the one that allows us to have confidence in staying underweight Canadian dollars to protect those portfolios.
Okay, so then a question from the app. What impacts may a weak Canadian dollar have on inflation? I guess that's you, Ilan.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, let me just quickly follow up on what DT mentioned.
Sure.
Right. So, again, we all worked at the Bank of Canada. There's a model that we use there that I'm sure they're still using today that said movements in the Canadian dollar, movements in the bilateral exchange rate between Canada and the US are a function of three things, right? Oil prices up, Canadian dollar up. The relative interest rate differential, right? So if Canada cuts and is here and the Fed is here, that's capital inflow into the US and that's an appreciation of the USD versus the Canadian dollar. And then sentiment, which is what DT described. Sentiment has definitely been the biggest factor, right? It's been that sort of anchor tied to the legs of the Canadian dollar. It's kind of grim, but anyway. but that first one, oil prices, right? The delinking is really significant. And when you think about it, like why has that decoupling occurred? It's occurred because oil investment in Canada has fallen by 50% since 2014. Right? That's one to write down. Oil investment, like that's new straws in the ground. I don't know how oil comes out of the ground, but in my head, it's a straw. So,
It's not straws.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm not an oil engineer, but investment in bringing new supply on in Canada is down 50% since 2014, yeah. Which means it's less of a tailwind for the Canadian economy. Right. So in 2008, I was at the BOC at the time. Canada came through the financial crisis, sort of first or second best in the G7. There was some high-fiving going on inside that institution, including, I mean, I high-fived some people. Part of that was we had five really well-capitalized banks and we didn't have those dodgy mortgages. The other thing, which we shouldn't ignore, is we had China growing at 15%, buying all sorts of commodities that we were digging out of the ground and exporting, right? So that tailwind is still there. It's just less of a factor. It lifts the boat less, which means it's less of a factor for the value of the Canadian dollar. On this question, and I'll invite my colleagues to weigh in as well, the impact of a weak Canadian dollar on inflation, I think about this very, very mechanically. So as I mentioned, my father-in-law telling me the price of things that went up and down at Costco, right. It makes those things more expensive, right? So if it costs more to import the stuff to put on the shelf at Costco, those things become more expensive. That's called pass-through. That's what the nerds call pass-through.
Yeah, you're importing inflation.
Exactly. Basically. You're importing inflation. That's the idea. That's not just for households. That's also for businesses that provide services. So it does show up elsewhere, right? If the electrical contractor has to pay more for what he's installing in your house, that shows up as well. So it's an upward arrow. What I would say, though, is today versus the 60s and 70s, the goods chunk of that basket is much smaller than it was back then. Right. So again, the most important driver of inflation right now, and probably for our lifetime, is service inflation, which is dictated by the price of the person doing the service.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, just to add on that in terms of the Bank of Canada's approach, and this is true of the Fed and other central banks in dealing with currency changes and the effect on inflation. So it's intuitive to say, if the Canadian dollar goes down, that makes imports more expensive, that makes prices higher, that makes inflation higher, that means that the Bank of Canada is less likely to cut interest rates. That's actually not how they think about it. So when you get a currency depreciation, that from the Bank of Canada's perspective is a level shift in prices. unless you think the currency is going to go down forever, it's not an impact on ongoing inflation. It's just a level shift, which means that they tend to want to look through it. So yes, the bank gets that if the currency is weaker, that you're going to get some transitory, you're going to get some inflation pressure for a period of time, but it's not the kind of thing that's going to prevent them from adding stimulus to the economy if they think stimulus needs to be added to the economy.
Interesting. Okay, so if we don't have the oil tailwind, as you indicated, Ivan, one other thing we talked about in the past, for instance, is housing. And you had some strong opinions on housing in Canada.
Yeah, I've had some strong opinions on housing for quite some time, as many of you folks know. Maybe make a couple of points on the Canadian housing market. First of all, linking it back to the productivity discussion we had earlier. So those two factors are inextricably linked. And the reason for that is what's happened in Canada over the last 20 years, call it. Returns from real estate have been steady and great. Returns from capital investment in businesses have been more volatile and not as great. So where do you put your investment dollars? You put your investment dollars in real estate. But that, in a sense, is the economy eating itself, because housing is an unproductive asset. You know, you need it, but it doesn't expand the economy's potential, its capacity, its output going forward, the way that investing in infrastructure or capital equipment or research and development would. So part of the challenge in Canadian productivity actually traces back to the fact that housing has been such a good investment relative to business investment in a way that was different from the United States. The second thing in terms of the housing market outlook, obviously forecasting the housing market is always very difficult, but I think in this state it has to do with, and arguably only to do with, what's happening in population growth. In the sense that, so if you go back again 15 or 20 years, I think the story of the Canadian housing market is you had really low interest rates for a really long time. You were coming off of a period in the 90s, it was really bad, and it just took off. And it was a lot of leverage, it was very cheap mortgages, other things were happening too, population growth, et cetera. With the normalization in interest rates in the last year or two, that support is gone. So what's replaced it is huge population growth, and Alon mentioned it, you know, it's you know, more than 1 million people over the past year. Well, if you already had a tight housing market situation and you have an unexpected 1 million people coming, I mean, what do you think is going to happen? You don't need a PhD for that. And so you have a very tight supply-demand situation, which is why prices have been remaining elevated. So if you can tell me what's going to happen with the effectiveness of caps on temporary foreign workers, on international students, et cetera, on curbing some of the very rapid population growth, if you can tell me what's going to happen with that, I can tell you what's going to happen with the housing market, and we'll have to see. But, you know, maybe a final point from a policy perspective, and there's a question on the budget, and there were a number of measures on housing in the budget, as there has been for a number of years. At least in my opinion, you know, that demographic demand that's come from the swell in population growth has been so important that if you deal with immigration, you probably don't have to do anything else in the housing market, because it will rebalance, taking away that demand. If you don't deal with immigration, it kind of doesn't matter what else you do, because supply is never going to be able to catch up quickly with demand. So
okay, so we don't have oil as the tailwind, because there hasn't been oil out of the ground for a while. Housing may or may not play in. Hugo made an interesting point. No, we haven't talked about commodities in ages. And he's looking at commodities changing. I'd love your input on that. I don't think I've ever asked you that in the past, because we haven't talked about commodities in, as he pointed out, 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, so as I mentioned, you know, we're more constructive on commodities, so we're making sure that that part of the Canadian story is something we're covering in our positioning. I agree with Hugo, you know, Dan was talking about it a little bit, Andrew, that there's something going on there in a way that there hasn't been for a decade. And I mean, it's one of, to step back a bit, it's one of the advantages I feel like we have in our seats as asset allocators, because we all talk. We talk to our underlying managers. We work with them very closely. They're coming at the world from a bottom-up point of view, and we're coming at the world from a top-down point of view. And so we're sharing our notes, so to speak, and when the bottom-up marries with the top-down, that's often a very powerful view that we can translate into positioning that's really going to help returns. And I think this is one of those cases. So, you know, Hugo and others talked about the bottom-up. On a top-down point of view, you know, it's demand is okay, and it's been okay, and if this soft landing continues, it's probably going to remain okay. And supply is limited, and that's true in oil, it's true in metals. Again, we've talked about it already through this conference, but it's hard to build a mine, it's hard to do an oil project. That's policy, that's environmental issues, that's geopolitics, et cetera. So supply basically hasn't grown for years and years, and if demand gets a little better, you get a big increase in price because you can't bring supply on very fast, at least outside of energy. So I think there's something there. We've increased our commodity positioning to some degree. Again, we're not over our skis because we know we're implicitly underweight commodities being underweight Canada. We want to make sure that we have plenty of that factor, in a sense, in the portfolios.
Anybody else want to add in? Okay, so you're talking about, you know, the bottom-up approach and the top-down approach that you're using. We don't bring into the equation, or we haven't discussed it yet today, Boston. You interact a lot with them, don't you?
Yeah, no, we as a team running the Canadian multi-asset funds are based in Toronto, but we're part of the broader asset allocation team for North America at Fidelity based in Boston. And we spend a lot of time with those folks. We really benefit from it in a couple of ways, and I'll invite my colleagues to add on to this. But, you know, two for me in particular, so we have very deep resources on research. So we have, I think it's 26 research analysts in Boston that are just dedicated to asset allocation and helping us make the kinds of decisions that we need to make. And then the other thing is we have, so I talked about our interactions with our underlying equity and fixed income managers, but we have colleagues who run a lot of money in multi-asset funds in the States. And we all talk, we all support each other. There's actually one meeting, my favorite meeting of the week, we do on Friday mornings, which is the group of us who do our job basically in North America, mostly in the US. And it's actually a fairly small number. There's only, I think, 8 or 9 of us. Yurian is also involved in that meeting. Around the table, we have something like $2 trillion in assets that the folks combined are responsible for. But in a sense, you would never know it. There's a lot of humility in that room. There's a lot of curiosity, a lot of openness. And we're basically having the conversation, I have this decision to make in my funds. What have you done there? What do you think about this? What research resources are you drawing on? It's a wonderfully constructive meeting. And it's also helpful because we're all trying to lift one another up, ultimately with the goal of all of our funds doing really well for all of our shareholders. And that's something that we I have the fortune of collaborating with folks on.
I think as a native Torontonian, the only time I don't listen to Boston is during the first round of the NHL playoffs that start on Saturday. There's a longstanding rivalry there. No, it's a tremendous source of inspiration and research for us. And I just want to stress one part of the relationship that I think is really important in the current context. So we're top-down thinkers. We spend a lot of time thinking about the macro, about central banks, about inflation and the unemployment rate. But what has been exceptionally helpful is getting all of the bottom-up sources of insight. Because if you think about macro models and the macro structure of the world, it's really changed through COVID and the aftermath. So relying on those signals, I think, only gets you so far in understanding where the market is going. So to be able to hear what analysts are getting from companies on a very real-time basis, that to me is just a huge enhancement to our process. And that comes very much from all of the researchers and the underlying portfolio managers and the analysts, many of which you've had a chance to listen to yesterday and later on today. So that as an input into our process, I think really does differentiate our ability as asset allocators to take those macro tilts. So we are deeply appreciative for those relationships.
And maybe, Pat, I'll just add something really quickly. This feels really fitting being on the Golden Globe stage, but remember these names. Olga, Greg, Noah, Joe, and Kate, right? These are people who you'll never normally hear from that we work with very, very closely on portfolio analysis and research that help in the day-to-day management of these funds. They're fantastic. They never get the shout out. And, you know, I guess I can't thank my parents on this stage, but I can thank them, which feels sort of fitting. So again, I lived in Boston for 7 years on the research team. I produced the research and now I'm a consumer of it. It's absolutely critical to everything we do.
I want to leave things, we only have a minute left. I want to leave things on a positive note. What do you see as the greatest opportunity? I want one word from each of you. Greatest opportunity in the next year, do you think?
Just one word?
One word. That's hard for you, I guess.
Funds.
Funds, okay, good. Yeah.
I'm gonna take two words, active management.
Active management, okay, excellent.
Less inflation?
That's two words.
Yeah, and with low conviction.
Gentlemen, thank you ever so much.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. Fidelity mutual funds and ETFs are available by working with a financial advisor or through an online brokerage account. Visit fidelity.ca/howtobuy for more information. Thanks again. See you tomorrow. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments